We open our Bibles again then at the Gospel of Luke, chapter 15. For the second of these five stories, under the general heading of Sting in the Tail, that we're looking at on Sunday nights. I'm starting to read at Luke 15, verse 11. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" When personal relationships break down, it's usually via one of two routes. Sometimes relationships are just blown apart by what you might call the big row. In a marriage, perhaps, it's the discovery of an adulterous affair that is the trigger. In an ordinary friendship, it will be some other kind of dispute, maybe, or injury that inflames tempers. But whatever the precise details, the resulting rift is sudden and explosive. One party tells the other, "I never want to see you again. Drop dead. Get lost." Some of us here, I guess, have experienced that kind of thing in some of our relationships, that sort of parting of the ways. We know well how traumatic it feels. It's a bit like a bereavement. This person who you've loved is suddenly snatched from your side and leaves an aching void, often full of bitterness and certainly of loneliness. It's a shattering experience, and all the more shattering because it erupts into our life with so little warning. 1 minute everything seems fine, and then the next our whole world has fallen apart. However, devastating though that kind of relational breakdown is, it's not the only way it happens, nor is it the most hopeless. Sometimes, relationships simply drift apart by what you might call not the big row, but the big freeze. There's no single crisis that precipitates this parting of the ways. The emotional disengagement is gradual. So gradual, you almost don't happen it noticing. You don't notice it happening. The marriage doesn't shatter under the assault of some external sexual temptation. It dies slowly from within. The friendship isn't terminated overnight. It slides by imperceptible degrees into mutual indifference. Affection cools. Communication dries up till one day we realize we've become strangers to one another. Not so much hostile as apathetic. Not so much angry as frigid. Because this isn't the big row. This is the big freeze. When relationships disintegrate in that second way, there's no volcanic disturbance as there is by a big row. But the result can be just as tragic, just as emotionally impoverishing. We may not have told the other person to get lost, but we lose out. That's the same. And perhaps even more irretrievably. At least, that's the warning which Jesus seems to be giving in this second story that we are studying tonight. The famous story of the prodigal son. Perhaps the most famous story he ever told. Before we plunge into it, I just want you to notice the very beginning of the chapter where it occurs. Verses 1 and 2 of Luke 15. Because they form an important scene-setting paragraph, which is an indispensable clue to the meaning of this story we're reading. Now the tax collectors and, quote, sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So there is a social context to this story, then. A division between two classes of people in Jewish society in the first century. What Luke calls sinners, and what we might, if you like, call saints. Sinners is perhaps an unfairly pejorative title, because not everybody in this class was categorized thus because of some personal moral failing on their part. It could simply be they had Gentile blood in them, or that they had contracted some illness, like leprosy, which made them ritually unclean. But it has to be said that a fairly high proportion of those who would have been called sinners in first century Jewish society were so called as a result of their chosen lifestyle. Some of them perhaps were drunkards. Some of them perhaps were sexually immoral. Some of them were corrupt collaborators with the detested occupying army of Rome, the tax collectors. These were the sorts of people then, or quite a few of them were, who were well, they didn't go to church on Sunday, they went down the pub. Now, they didn't pray on their knees, they prayed on their neighbours. As you might expect, respectable religious people in Israel gave all such sinners the cold shoulder. They were outcasts. To keep company with such people was to be defiled by them, to be, as we would say, tarred with the same brush. Religious people saw themselves as the saints. Racially pure Jews, physically whole, no leprosy or anything like them about or anything like that about them, and morally certainly impeccable. And they kept God's law to the letter, the saints did, studying their Bibles with a zeal that would put many Christians to shame, and observing it with such a rigid and uncompromising pedantry. Well, in Cambridge these days you would only see such pedantry, I think, among traffic wardens and certain college porters, I could mention. Chief among these saints were the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Now, the Pharisees were a first century fundamentalist club, a bit like the Kick You. And the teachers of the law were a group of professional Bible scholars, a bit like the Divinity Faculty. Between them, they constituted a formidable spiritual elite, possessing huge social prestige and not inconsiderable political power in first century Judea, where religion was part of the structure of society in a way that it's long since ceased to be in Britain. Naturally, they assumed that any would-be rabbi, as we would call him, a pastor or a Bible teacher, any would-be rabbi would seek their seal of approval. If he didn't have a degree from their divinity faculty, he could at least aspire to a KQ membership card, couldn't he? The last thing they expected of a would-be rabbi was that he would abandon the company of the saints altogether in order to socialize with the first century equivalent of the rugby club. But that's what Jesus did. Quite clearly what he did. Oblivious to the consequences it would have for his reputation, he not only welcomed these so-called sinners, he ate with them to their shock and amazement. He shared dinner with them regularly. Can you imagine anything so disgusting, the saints were saying to one another? Why, in 20th century terms, it would be a bit like seeing Mother Teresa in a singles bar in Soho. It would awaken that same kind of bewilderment. It'd be a bit like seeing Cliff Richard in a gay pride march. They couldn't make sense of it, you see. It was totally out of keeping with social expectation for a man who claimed to be holy to mix with sinners. The disjuncture between saints and sinners in the minds of those religious leaders of the first century was absolute. And by breaching this social taboo, well, Jesus was, in fact, quite literally, as it eventually turned out, signing his own death warrant, as far as they were concerned. However, you don't find Jesus embarrassed or on the defensive or apologetic about this social policy of his. On the contrary, if you were here last week, you may remember that this isn't the first time he has deliberately scandalized the religious establishment in Judea. Back in Luke 14, he had caused similar controversy at a dinner party thrown by a prominent Pharisee, you remember. And on that occasion, his response to the sanctimoniousness of those around him had been to tell a story. A parable, as he called it. A parable which, as we said last week, was a bit like a stealth bomber. It penetrated the psychological defenses of his hostile audience so it could target a missile at some of their most cherished and preconceived ideas. Well, here in Luke 15, his strategy is the same. He finds himself under attack for his policy of eating with sinners. So he again tells a parable. Indeed, not a single parable this time, but three parables, if you notice carefully. The parable of the lost sheep in verses 3 to 7, of the lost coin in verses 8 to 10, and then finally the lost son in verses 11 to 32. And it's that third and last story which is the object of our study tonight. It is, I think you'll agree, the most famous story Jesus ever told. I doubt whether anybody here who has any kind of Christian upbringing at all is completely unfamiliar with it. It's a story about relationships, isn't it? A triangle of domestic tension between a father and two sons. In each case, the relationship is broken between the father and the son. Each boy is, at least for part of the story, left alone, isolated. In one case, this happens as a result of a big row. In the other case, it happens as a result of a big freeze kind of situation. The interesting thing is, though, that the boy who's alienated from his father by the first route, through the big row, is eventually reconciled. But the second boy, the one who is outside the circle because of a big freeze, for him the story ends in an open-ended way. The curtain comes down. We don't know. Jesus doesn't tell us whether he is ever fully reconciled to his father and his brother or not. As with all of Jesus' parables, you see, underneath these superficial details, there's a spiritual message. Jesus is telling us that our relationship with God is a bit like these two boys. Some people, their rebellion against God is open and defiant. They have a big row with God. They angrily turn their back on him. They say, "I wish you were dead, God." Others, well, they like to call themselves the saints. But there is still rebellion there. It's secret and disguised. They maintain a polite, nodding acquaintance with God, but they are careful that he never gets too close. They keep him at arm's length. They like to call themselves the saints. But underneath, there is a coldness of heart. Jesus' warning is very simple. When it comes to going to heaven, the sinners have the better chance. The people who see themselves in that class, they have the better chance, for their position is retrievable. But these so-called saints, if they're not very careful, their smug self-righteousness may place them beyond hope of redemption. A solemn story, then. Read it with me. There was a man who had two sons. The younger said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. And not long after that, the younger son got all together and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. Well, you see what I mean by it being a classic case of the big row. We know this story well enough, don't we? A teenage boy rebels against his wealthy farmer, his father. In days like ours, where such family disputes are commonplace, and you will find many young kids of 16 or 17 sleeping in the park in Cambridge tonight with a story like this to tell. Well, it's easy, perhaps, for the scandalous nature of what this boy is suggesting here in the opening verse of the story to lose its impact on us. But in a first century Eastern context, and even in a Middle Eastern context today, I think, if you were to ask someone from one of the Arab countries, they would very quickly recognize that what this boy was asking of his father was absolutely scandalous, absolutely preposterous. "Father, give me my share of the estate," you see? It was tantamount to saying, "Dad, I wish you were dead." That's how any Middle Eastern person would interpret such a request. "Dad, I wish you were dead." Indeed, I suspect for a first century audience, the impertinence of this boy's request would have been exceeded only by their astonishment at the father's acquiescence. So he divided his property between them. What sort of parent is this who accedes to his children's reckless demands for truant independence? The answer is, of course, a divine. But this is a parable. Jesus is drawing a picture for us here of how human beings, made in the image of God, find themselves alienated from him as a result of their moral rebellion. "God," we say to him, "I wish you were dead. I like the material things which you can give me. I like them, but I don't like you. I want them, but I don't want you. God, I wish you were dead. Get out of my life, God. Stop interfering with me." But ironically, you see, we are the ones who lose out every time when we say that. He squandered his wealth in wild living. And what happens? After he had spent everything, there is a severe famine in that whole country and he begins to be in need. He goes and hires himself to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longs to fill his stomach with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. What was he looking for, this young guy? Freedom? It's a word we often bandy around, isn't it? freedom from moral inhibitions, liberation from the shackles of outmoded conventions, freedom from our parents' cramping lifestyle, freedom to discover our real identity. We want to be free. Do you see, this boy found freedom was a more complicated thing than he thought. Imagine a guy on a cliff. I'm free, he says. I'm free. Free to jump, free to dance, free to fly like a bird. So he launches himself off the cliff. And he flies like a bird, all the way to the bottom. He doesn't appreciate the gravity of the situation. Now seriously, some of us as a result of our jobs, spend quite a bit of time clearing up the mess at the bottom of that particular cliff. Freedom, you see, is not freedom to do as you like. Properly understood, freedom is the freedom, the liberty to do as you ought. The freedom to be what you were meant to be. We human beings are not unconstrained creatures. There are norms. Without those norms, freedom is meaningless. Indistinguishable from the arbitrariness of a person who just makes decisions by tossing coins all the time. Well, that boy may have been looking for freedom, but he didn't find the freedom he was looking for when he broke free from his father. All he found was the stink of a pigsty. And Jesus is surely pointing there out to us by this dissatisfied, degraded individual. The tragedy of all of us, when we in our folly try to be free in a way we cannot possibly be free. To become our own masters, the captain of our own souls. It doesn't work. Human beings aren't meant to live that way. We are made by God and we cannot escape our creatureliness. See what Jesus comments in that verse 16? No one gave him anything. There's pathos in those words, isn't there? He no doubt found plenty of people willing to exploit his hunger, but they were all takers, they weren't givers. The same thing is true today, of course, isn't it? Some of these young rebels, perhaps, out on the streets tonight. The drug pushers will be looking for them, anxious to sell them something that will give them a buzz, give them a trip. But they're not really interested in them, are they? Just interested in their money. They want to see them feeble and wretched and begging for the next fix. They're not givers, they're takers. Same goes for the prostitute or the Casanova. They tell us sex is the answer. They promise to give us love, but the truth is they don't give at all. It's just another kind of taking. Think about the dabbler in magic, the occult, the Eastern guru who comes over advertising his meditation lectures. They all assure you they are here to give you answers to your spiritual quest. Look carefully. They're not givers. They're takers. Here was this boy, you see, hungry in his pigsty and comments Jesus, nobody gave him anything. Maybe you've already found that out. Perhaps you've had your fling in search of freedom. And it's turned to ashes in your mouth too. Deep down now, there's a gnawing vacuum, just like the hole in his stomach. Why is it? Jesus is telling you why. You're off the track. You've ignored the rules. You're trying to be something you can't be. Free from God. You've flouted the norms of human existence. And the situation isn't going to get any better till you face up to it. Mercifully, that's what this young fellow did. The turning point begins, doesn't it, there in verses 16 and 17. No one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. At last, you see, the boy starts to do something right for a change. The first thing he does right, which is easily missed, is to refuse to eat the pig food. Jesus tells us quite explicitly, he was inclined to. When you're very hungry, you'll eat anything. But what a tragedy if he had. What a tragedy if his hunger had led him to a degraded appetite, satisfied with second best, pig food. Yet that is a real danger, of course. There are many people who get to the point of desiring some deeper meaning in life, even search a little for it. Most people do at some point in their life, don't they? But finding no immediate answer, or no palatable answer, maybe, they capitulate. They settle for second best. They eat the pig food that's on offer and make their home in the pigsty. When I was a student, back in the 60s, that was, you know, we were political then, far more interested in social affairs than students are today. All students want to do today is get degrees and go out and earn money, but we had principles. So we went out and waved banners. We didn't bother to study, we had riots instead. Quite a few of my friends were involved in that, waving their red flags, or sometimes their black flags. They shouted their protests. Of course, I know where most of them are now. You know where they are? In the City of London. Bank managers, stockbrokers, that sort of thing. I remember we had a great hero, one of these South American revolutionary types. I read in Time magazine about 5 years ago, he's just opened a boutique in Paris. Disillusionment and cynicism have a way of creeping up and corroding our youthful idealism. We find nothing better to live for than the materialism that is around us. We find our revolutions don't work the way they were meant to work. So we give in. And our spiritual hunger for something better, something nobler, it withers. We're satiated by the pig food, you see. But at the expense, perhaps, of some of our dignity. Now, the strange thing is, that boy's hunger was also his hope. If he'd eaten the pig food, all would have been lost. The first thing he did right was to refuse to dehumanize himself in that way. The first thing he did right was to stay hungry. To go on thinking, to go on searching, in spite of that hunger that was gnawing at his soul. The most tragic thing about many people in this world is that they are in the pigsty and they are eating the pig food and they are oblivious to the fact. They have stopped looking for anything better. But that, of course, wasn't enough. No, says Jesus, he not only refused to eat the pig food, he also took a long, hard look at his situation and faced up to some unpleasant truths. Because that takes courage, doesn't it? To really look in the mirror and face up to what you see. None of us like doing that. We live a lot closer to despair than perhaps we can afford to admit. It takes great audacity to surrender our precious delusion. We are really very successful, together people, and admit that deep down inside we are falling apart and we don't know where we're going. It takes courage to stop playing a role, doesn't it? Because most of us hide our uncertainty about ourselves behind a mask. For some of us it's the cool academic type. For others it's the muscular athletic type. For some, it's the girl who knows how to handle boys type. For For some, it's the shy, lovable type. For some, it's the life and soul of the party type. For the some, it's the aloof, detached, I don't need anybody type. Some students, I find, in this university even develop a kind of schizophrenia. They adopt different roles depending on where they are and who they're with. One for home and one for here. One for church and one for in their college. Fundamentally, it's because they're insecure. They don't know who they really are, or want to be, or are meant to be. They are confused, as this boy was confused, about their identity. And tragically, some never get out of that role play. They get older, the roles change, but the masks are even more firmly fixed to their face. Eventually, they never come off. Not even in those quiet, private moments, when there's nobody to see. No, it does take a lot of courage to get away from the audience and engage in radical self-examination. Jesus is saying here, it can't be avoided. That courage is required of us if we're going to get out of this hole we're in. There are some truths we've just got to face up to. What are they? Quite simply, he says. The first truth is the truth that we are lost. That our dissatisfied, unhappy lives are so ultimately because we are lost. The root of this boy's problem, he realized, as he sits there in his pigsty, is not that he lacks something called food, but that he lacks someone called Father. Augustine, whom the church history seminar is about next Saturday, and one of the greatest prodigals of them all, came to the same discovery. You have made us for yourself, he says to God, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you. We toy around with material things, trying to slake a thirst that fundamentally lies not in the material realm, but in the personal realm. That's why, of course, personal relationships are so important to us. That's why the nearest thing we can experience that gets anywhere near satisfying that hole is personal relationships. Love. That experience is just a pointer, you see, to that ultimate relationship for which we were made as human beings. It's a reflection of that greater destiny for which we were made, in fellowship with God. But no human relationship can ever really satisfy the hunger of our soul. And we kid ourselves if we think it can. It's just one more route to disillusionment if we invest that kind of ultimate importance, that kind of expectation in a boyfriend or girlfriend. It will let us down. You cannot integrate your whole meaning as a human being around any personal relationship with any human being, no matter how wonderful, no matter how much you love them. They can't sustain that weight. For it's a weight only God can carry. Sartre, the French philosopher, an atheist, but how perfectly he speaks for modern men and women when he says, that God does not exist, I cannot doubt, but that my whole being cries out for God, I cannot deny. An honest man, even if he was an atheist. Now this boy realizes, you see, sitting in his pigsty, his true identity is as a son of a father. That's where he had gone wrong. He tried to run away from that identity. He sought freedom. He failed to realize there are some freedoms that are just not accessible to us because they contradict who we are. Jesus would have us reach the same conclusion. Our bid for moral autonomy is doomed to failure. You can't run away from God. The hole will still be there, aching, which he has left. That's the first thing he has to face up to, that he's lost. The second thing, that he's guilty. I will arise and say to my father, I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Jesus reminds us there, you see, that it is our moral decision to try and be free from God that is at the root of this mess we've got ourselves into. We've flouted his rules, and as a result, we have offended him. We've hurt him. We have sinned against heaven and in your sight, he says. It's important we understand that some people think of God like some kind of, well, like some kind of traffic warden, who's got these kind of impersonal laws that he's duty-bound to enforce, but which he doesn't really feel terribly involved in. They're just objective, neutral rules out there that he's enforcing like some kind of magistrate, like some kind of traffic warden. Not like that at all. The moral law is the law of God's own heart and nature. When we sin, when we fail to love people as he says we should, when we fail to speak the truth as he tells us we should, when we fail to honour our parents as he says we should, and particularly when we fail to love him and honour him as he says we should, we're not just parking on a heavenly double yellow line. We're parking on the policeman's foot. We're offending him personally. That's how he feels about it. Angry. Hurt. If you have any doubt about that, then look at the cross. It is there to show us how much the sin of the world offends, angers, hurts God. And consequently how much it costs him to keep the door of reconciliation open. Now, we are guilty. That was the second thing the boy had to realize. Not just that he was lost, but that he was guilty. Not just that he needed the Father's fellowship, but that he needed the Father's forgiveness. Once he discovered that, says Jesus, only a few short steps separated him from joy. But I think, don't you, they must have been the hardest steps he ever took in his entire life. I will arise and go back to my father. There's a story told about a minister who met one of these runaway kids who had run away from home, like I say, on the streets, and counseled him. He pointed him to this very passage. He said, now, you go back to your father and see if he doesn't kill the fatted calf to welcome you. Some weeks later, he met the boy again. Did you go back to your dad? He said. Yes, I did, he said. And did you apologize? Yes, I did, he said. And did he kill the fatted calf? No, he said. He jolly well near killed the prodigal son. There is something, isn't there, very amazing in this story about the warmth of the father's reception of this boy. It's so unlike most of us to be reconciled so totally with no recriminations, no grievances. While he is still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, kissed him. It would have been so human, wouldn't it, for the father to have made the boy squirm a bit for his folly, to have demanded some restitution, some punishment. But we hear none of that. Instead, we see a wonderful readiness to forgive. He seems to have been waiting and watching, even while the boy's back was turned against him. See how he runs to him? You know, in the ancient world, that was something. A senior man of this man's generation just did not do. You didn't pick up your gown and start running once you were over 30 or 40, you know. This wasn't the sort of thing you did in public. It was extremely humiliating and undignified. But clearly this man's heart is so full that it compels him. Careless of the embarrassment or the indignity that his neighbours might think. He's filled, says Jesus, with compassion for the boy. He goes and throws his arms around him and to translate the Greek a little more precisely, covers him with tender kisses. That's what the word suggests. The boy, of course, has determined that he's going to try and make it up, isn't he? I'll offer to work as a wage labourer for my dad on the farm to repay the money I've so recklessly wasted. But the father won't hear any of it. He doesn't even give him the chance, the opportunity to make such an offer. He interrupts the boy, doesn't he, in mid-confession. Quick, he says, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. This son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. What is Jesus saying? What is Jesus saying? He's saying something very wonderful. He's saying that if we have had a big row with God, and if our relationship with him is in tatters as a result, things can be put back right again. That if we will come back to him in real repentance, turning from our rebellion and our foolish independence, and seek his face again, he is not going, as many a human father would do, to grind our faces into the dirt beneath his feet. He's not going to make us feel ashamed. He will not put us into some kind of cast iron bondage, some chains, but as punishment. Jesus is teaching us here the reliability of God's grace and mercy. He's not going to hold any grievance against us, he says. On the contrary, he will rejoice, and all heaven with him, to have us back again. Sure, we have turned our back on him. In 100 ways, we've told him to get lost. But no matter how big the row that divided us, he wants to make it up. He will make it up. Even now he waits. Even now, Jesus suggests, he waits for sinners. People who know they're on the wrong side of him to come back. And when they do, he will not let them take the role of a slave. He insists they will be his sons and his daughters. It's so nice, wouldn't it, if Jesus had ended the story there? I mean, don't you feel that's where it ought to end? I mean, we've got to the end, haven't we? This is where the curtain comes down. This is where the humming music starts to play. It's the happy ending. But unfortunately, well, yes, unfortunately, he doesn't. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. Why does Jesus introduce this guy? Think back to what we said at the very beginning. Think back to the original context. This parable, you see, was not primarily designed as a therapeutic word of comfort to those sinners that Jesus was eating with. This word was primarily designed as a stealth bomber charged with the mission of exploding the complacency of those so-called saints who were criticizing him eating with the sinners. And it is them, those so-called saints, this elder brother so clearly represents. You see what he says about himself in verse 29? Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Well, there's a perfect son for you. Surely this guy has to be Jesus' ideal. All these years he's been slaving for the Father and never disobeyed him. No, not so. For this obedience, you see, was the obedience of duty, of servility. It even comes out in the way he puts it. I've been slaving for you. Can't you hear the petulance in that? The whining self-pity? Can't you hear the thinly veiled grudge, the seething resentment? All these years I've been slaving for you, working my fingers to the bone for you. Don't we know exactly what people mean when they talk like that? His do-gooding had no more liberated him as a personality than his brother's licentiousness had. It has rendered him humorless, prudish, constrained his affections, incapable of enjoying himself, repressed, inhibiting, pouting, censorious. He condemns his brother, but not because he really feels outraged by his brother's behavior. He condemns his brother because he envies him. See what he says? He's wasted your living, your property, with prostitutes, the tacit unsaid thing being, I would have liked to have done that, but I never did. You've never given me a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends, he says. He's jealous of him. Simple as that. There are hundreds of people like that today. Respectable people. Conventional people. Good people. They look down their noses at the permissive society. They curl their lip at the decay in moral standards. They think they're good. But they are not good. They're just dull. They think they're being moral. They are not. They're merely feeling uncomfortable. They think they are Christian. They are not. They are Pharisees. And Jesus would have us know the difference is huge. Joyless in their hypocrisy. Sterile in their respectability. Their religion has no more in common with Christianity than a frigid marriage has in common with a real love affair. This elder brother had fallen victim to the big freeze. Oh yes, he was still there, sleeping in the same house. But his relationship with the Father was as far apart as that young boy had been when he was in the most distant country of all. Do you see what Jesus says of him? He refused to go in. Can you imagine that? To miss the party. His Father is throwing this great celebration and he hasn't got the grace to go in and enjoy it. Instead he makes this big public scene on the doorstep. All the neighbours looking through the window. Oh boy. Can you imagine the embarrassment of the Father in such a situation, particularly in the Middle East? And yet in spite of all that, the arms of mercy are open to this boy just as they were open to the younger one. See how he comes out to him? Comes out to him just as he went out to the younger boy. He pleads with him just as he showed compassion to that other boy, so he pleads with this one. He encourages him, he persuades him. He speaks to him with great tenderness and affection. Son, he said, my son, my child, you could almost translate that. Everything I have is yours. You are precious to me. How can you doubt it? But no. He refused to go. Could anyone be so foolish? So foolish as to choose hell in preference to heaven? Oh yes. People can be that stupid. And I'll tell you why in a single word. Pride. Pride is the Macintosh that grace just cannot get through. Think of that younger boy when he'd been in the pigsty. He's come to his senses. He's seen what a fool he's been. But he could have still stayed there, couldn't he? If he had kept his pride, he'd have stayed in that pigsty and endured it rather than face the humiliation of going back to his father. Now, the reason that younger boy was rescued and reconciled was because he had the humility to repent. Lots of people feel remorse over their lives. Lots of people kick themselves and say, what a fool I've been. But that feeling will not take you to heaven. For remorse is just wounded pride. It's just wallowing in self-pity. That's not repentance. Repentance begins when you get up and come to the Father. And it was that pride, that willingness to humble himself and to go into the house, that this elder brother lacked. It was his pride kept him outside. Just as it was their pride that would keep those Pharisees and those teachers of the law outside the kingdom of heaven. Just as it was their pride that would keep their standing there as they nailed Jesus to the cross and gave consent to his death. Sometimes we have this picture, don't we, of God sorting out the human race into those who are going to heaven and those who are going to hell. The ones he likes he sends to heaven, the ones he doesn't like he sends to hell. That isn't the picture Jesus gives us here, is it? He gives us a picture here of a God who is overflowing with grace and generosity, who opens his arms to all. Elder brother, younger brother, saint or sinner, he doesn't care what class or label we carry. He opens his arms of generosity and grace to all without distinction. Now, if we stay out of heaven, it is because we refuse to go in, says Jesus. It is because we will not have his grace. We're too proud to accept it. We don't want grace. Like this elder brother, we want a reward. All these years I've been slaving for you. Jesus would tell us, you cannot have a reward. You can only have heaven as a gift. You can only have it as a gift. A gift you're humble enough to receive. Could it be that pride is really what keeps you back from being a Christian? Oh, maybe you're like the younger brother. You've had a big row with God. You're in that distant country or in that pigsty. You've thought about it. You know a lot of what Jesus is saying about him is true of you. Could it be pride that keeps you in the pigsty? Unwilling to come back? Or maybe you're like the elder brother, grown up in a Christian home, religious background. Always gone to church, very morally minded. But as John Wesley said in the years before he became a Christian, I had then, he said, the religion of a servant, not of a son. Is that you? The religion of a servant and a slave. Not the warm and intimate relationship of a child of God. Why? It's your pride, isn't it? The pride that wants to earn your ticket. And hasn't yet learned to open your arms to God's arms and say, thank you. Could it be pride that is the problem? Some of us would feel a lot more at ease about becoming a Christian if only we could walk into heaven with our heads held high and everybody clapping and congratulating us. You made it! What an achievement! Well done, old chap! But none of us actually will enter heaven in quite that way. For there is only one way back to the Father, says Jesus. And that's on our knees. Humbly. Accepting his grace and mercy. Pray together.